Hello and welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast. This is Mark Williams, broadcasting to you from Cambridgeshire in the UK. I have two guests on the show this week, two colleagues who come to talk about a report that they've just published all about the risk of investing in LNG as a marine fuel. They are co-authors of this report. The first, Marie Fricaudet, is a PhD student at University College London. Marie comes with an MSc in public policy from the University Sciences Polytechnic in Paris and London School of Economics and Political Science. She is lead author of this report, Exploring Methods for Understanding Stranded Value, the Case Study on LNG-Capable Ships, as well as a recent article, Understanding the Scale of Stranded Asset Risk in the Shipping Industry. Her interests and areas of expertise include financial climate risks, shipping decarbonisation, and stranded asset risk in shipping. Marie works with Dr. Tristan Smith, Associate Professor at UCL Energy Institute, where he's worked for 12 years. Tristan is very well known to many of us as Director of University Maritime Advisory Services, UMass, where he leads a group of students focusing on studying the global shipping industry. They combine expertise across engineering, economics, programming, optimization, operational research, policy, business, and finance. Dr. Smith has a master's degree in engineering from the University of Cambridge and an MSc and PhD in naval architecture from University College London. Tristan, Marie, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you on.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So for those who haven't read the report or don't know of it, please could you tell us what is it called and what are its main findings?
So the report is called Exploring Methods for Understanding Stranded Value, a case study on LNG-capable ships. And in this report, a first output is a set of methods to try to understand to quantify what would be the stranded value of a ship or of a fleet if the shipping sector is to decarbonize. So this set of methods can be applied to different types of ships and different types of fuels, but we use them on a specific case study, which is LNG-capable ships. And in one specific scenario, which rests on two main assumptions. First one is that the uptake of LNG-capable ships, which we've observed in the last few years, continues and accelerates until 2030. And the second assumption is that in 2030, you have a certain increase in ambition to decarbonize the shipping industry and an uptake of zero emissions shipping solutions. So in terms of actual findings on this specific case study, it highly depends on the technology which becomes dominant or cost competitive in 2030. And so the results vary a lot, but could go up to $850 billion on LNG-capable ships by then, if LNG-capable ships are not able to move to a zero-emission solution, essentially. But if they are able to retrofit, in particular, we use the case of ammonia, then they are able to save most of their value, but that would still come at a cost, which essentially is 15 to 25% of their second-hand value would be stranded in that case.
Thank you. Can I just ask, Are these findings produced by a mathematical model? You don't have to go into the maths, but what was the methodology?
Yeah, it's a modeling approach. Three main points. One modeling approach to model the evolution of the fleet until 2030, and that's based on our existing model, Glotram. One modeling approach, which is more regression to model the value of the fleet until then. And one new model, so a new approach, which models what would be the value of a ship if in competition, so LNG-capable ship in our case, if in competition with other ships on the market and if they are in need to move to an alternative fuel, so in competition with conventional fuels or ammonia or zero-emission new builds. So yeah, it's quantitative methods.
Okay, thank you, yeah. So there is this risk of vessels being stranded assets and therefore of making a loss for the investors in them, for the ship owners, which, of course, is a concern. If you're considering building a new ship today, do you want an LNG dual fuel ship or should you wait or, you know, what are the options? And that's always the difficult part. Do you think that LNG-capable vessels could convert somehow in order to reduce this stranded asset risk. So maybe they could use biofuel or even synthetic fuel, or maybe mix hydrogen into the LNG. We hear up to 20% hydrogen mixture could be added to LNG. Would that improve their carbon footprint and therefore reduce asset risk?
Yes. So technically, they are able to run on bio-LNG and e-LNG. So those are dropping fuels. Previous analysis from UMass and UCL, and Tristan can probably talk more about it, has showed that those might not be scalable or cost competitive in the future. But yeah, if those fuels are available and in large scale and cost competitive way, then they would be able to move directly to them without changing the engine. So that means that the stranded value would be essentially zero. Now, if they do have to retrofit because those fuels are not available, they are still able to save most of their value, as you said. And that's what the report shows. Most of their value would be saved, but that would still come at a cost, not only because they have to pay for the retrofit, but also because they would be in competition with conventional fuels, which are also able to retrofit if they are cheaper, and with new builds, zero emission new builds, which might push their value downward. By being able to retrofit or to move to another fuel, they are able to save most of their value.
So it is possible, but it comes with its own risks and its own costs. Mm. Yeah.
That's why we talk about stranded value and not stranded asset per se. We're not saying necessarily that those ships are going to be scrapped, but we're saying that part of their value might be lost on the way.
So accelerated depreciation, if you like.
Yeah, and early obsolescence.
Early obsolescence, yes. It's a little bit like the single hull tanker phase out.
Yeah.
Late era single hull tankers ended up being technically obsolete before they were commercially obsolete.
Exactly, yes.
So what do you think, do you have any recommendations in your report? What do you think ship owners can do? What proactive steps can they take today to manage stranded value risk?
So for our specific case study, LNG capable ships, we showed that there is a large amount of value at risk. So, and given their limited greenhouse gas benefits today and their cost premium, one obvious takeaway is maybe to avoid ordering more and avoid going into the scenario which we've modeled, which is a high uptake of LNG. Now, the methods we've developed are applicable to a larger range of fuels, and LNG is not the only fuel which is at risk of being stranded, if you want, in the future. So conventional fuel, we enter a period of uncertainty. It's a period of transition, so you don't know what future consumer demand will be, future policy will be, future technology will be. Although the need to decarbonize is there to stay, it's true that you enter a period of uncertainty. So ordering ships which are, using zero emission fuels if possible, if not at least are retrofitable to zero emission fuels is a good idea. As we've showed in the report, LNG capable ships are able to save most of their value if they can retrofit. Ordering fuel efficient ship might be a good idea as well, because it's cheaper to retrofit an efficient ship than an inefficient one. And maybe for the ships which are particularly at risk, use shorter profiles for depreciation might be a good idea. I don't know if Tristan, you want to add something to this list of recommendations.
No, I think you've got it all. I think there are two types of things to do: the technical options that you've described, how to kind of make your vessel as fuel flexible or as versatile as possible, which is really sort of options theory, which isn't, in our experience, particularly used in the shipping industry today, but maybe it's going to become a useful tool. So spotting how to value the optionalities that your vessel gives you and how you then modify the specification in order to maximize that. But there are also the kind of commercial and financial aspects of this. And I think the key concern that we had was the transparency with which the sector at the moment is representing some of the future risk, the downside in this particular asset class, given that it's where a large amount of new building activity is happening. LNG has a window that is initiated particularly with the 2020 sulfur regulation and what was a low gas price relative to oil prices. So it opens at one point in time and it closes at another point in the future when we are undertaking a much, much more aggressive rate of decarbonisation and fossil fuels can no longer be used. So if that window has been squeezed at this end, you know, the prices that we have at the moment and for the immediate future are high for gas and LNG, so there's not an obvious commercial opportunity in the earlier point in time. We see developments of machinery all the time. We see investment into hydrogen and ammonia accelerating very fast. And that brings the closure, because the point at which, you know, the next generation will come along closer, that kind of closing of the window should be anticipated. It's an entirely foreseeable evolution. It's an entirely consistent outcome from a transition, and that needs to be integrated into the way that commercial financing, insuring decisions are being taken in this decade, so we don't end up in a situation at the end of the decade where everyone's throwing their hands in the air as if this was a surprise, because it really shouldn't be a surprise.
Yes, we have a good 20 years notice, don't we?
Right.
And that point at which the costs converge for the different alternatives is visible. If we don't know exactly when it is, we know what it will look like, at least.
We know what it'll look like. And I think that a lot of the anxiety or concern around decision-making has been trying to guess the exact point in time that it happens, right? So is it 26? Is it 28? Is it 30? You know, it's clearly a fool's game to try and guess precisely where it is. But these are purchases of assets which have 20 to 30-year economic lives. So whether it's 26 or 30 is irrelevant if you're taking that perspective. And I think we need to move on from a debate which is about, oh, this is 22% reduction in CO2 at this point in time, and look across the three decades, because it will be brutal. And if we don't have a proper discussion now about how brutal it's going to be and factor that in, we will cause more disruption and damage to the sector. And that's not good for anybody.
Yeah. I speak to a lot of ship owners a lot of the time, and you know, they see these risks, and some of them try to model these risks, and some of them try to work out when they can switch to zero carbon fuels, whether it's liquefied hydrogen or fuel cells or ammonia or some other hydrogen carrier. And a number of them take the view that they should just wait until a winner technology becomes available. And their assumption is that in the meantime, as there is less investment in ships, then the freight market will improve, and you know they're going to enjoy a bumper decade until the technology is ready for them to invest all the profits they make between now and the early 2030s in the next generation of vessels. Does that sound like a good strategy?
It doesn't sound like classical behavior in the shipping markets. In your experience, how long do you sustain high freight rates before someone disruptive comes in and decides to take advantage? So you can certainly wait. I mean, that's clearly one strategy, and it's one way to manage the risks. But I think what Marie's produced is something that allows a rigorous trade-off of the risks, the trade-off of the risk of waiting, the estimation of stranded value as a function of machinery specification. So we're not saying that any fossil-fueled vessel is immune to stranded value, but some might have higher stranded value than others. And so you can estimate that and build it into your decision making now. But you are leaving yourself open to, you know, new entrants, to corruption, because as soon as finance mobilizes towards zero emission solutions, if you're not there, you just face diminishing market share. And I'm sure there aren't many in the sector today who would like to see that happen to their own commercial position.
Mary, do you have anything to add on that? Do you think ship owners should just wait, or does your report suggest they should start strategizing now?
I think that the report doesn't take a strong view on it takes a view on what shouldn't be done, but it doesn't exactly advise on what should be done. It gives you a method to compare the different options of what could be done or not done. I think, yes, waiting is definitely an option for not facing stranded value. But if you don't, as Tristan say, if you leave others take the role of first mover and order zero emission ships now or in the future, then you just create the situation where you might disappear from the shipping market. I think building capacity, building experience, building a reputation of being able to use those fuels is also valuable.
There's often no advantage to being the first mover in shipping. You know, if it's introducing new technology, the advantage comes to the second wave, who get to use the technology at a slightly cheaper price because they haven't had all the development costs baked in. But they get the advantage of operating vessels with that technology, like things like the single hull phase out for tankers, or the common structural rules for shipbuilding, or the engine efficiency regulations, or the sulfur emission regulations.
But what you're describing, Mark, is the compliance dynamic. This isn't a transition that follows that pattern. Already you can see that this is about customers of shipping, as well as other stakeholders who impinge on the sector. So scrubber compliance or ballast water, you tick the box and then you continue to operate. And clearly, the later you tick the box, the lower the cost of that retrofit or the specification, and you let somebody else take all the hit on the costs of developing or cost reducing the technology. But there are customers of shipping that are making it clear they want zero emission shipping services today. I understand from Maersk that they sell about 1% of their total business as their eco product, which is a biofuel product, but it's a market share that has grown incredibly fast. Now, 1% is still tiny. 99% is not that, but that will grow rapidly as we go through this decade. And they are ordering ships that will enable them to move to the next version of that and take that market share as it evolves. There's an access to capital. You know, there's capital which has evidenced, at least in other sectors, that it'll have a lower cost relative to those that are financing fossil assets. And so this isn't as simple as being about in compliance or not. And there is opportunity as well as risk in both kind of sides of the decision making, which is why I think it would be risky to presume that that well-known phrase, there's no advantage to being first, is applicable in this situation. It also assumes that the speed that this moves is something that you can catch up with. So if you know that there's a 2020 regulation coming in, you can go, right, I'll book my slot for November in 2019 or something for the retrofit. But as we discussed just now, the timing is unpredictable, right? There's a technology evolution that's happening incredibly fast. There's a production supply chain of energy evolution that's happening incredibly fast. And there's regulation which is entirely unpredictable. And so it's hard to second guess these things. Whereas what some ship owners are showing is that you can get your asset, your vessel, aligned to a future with a lower cost of capital now, which means you're not exposed to the guessing game or the timing. So I think it is something that needs this more nuanced trade-off of all the upside and downside or opportunity and risk and the tools to enable that.
Yeah, I often tell my customers, you know, if you want to make a decision on this, the first thing to do is to speak to your customers and, you know, ask them where will they be in 5 to 10 years' time and try to anticipate whether or not you can join them on that journey. You know, and you don't have to join them on the journey. You can decide to do something else.
Absolutely.
But I do warn my customers that if you don't go on the journey, you face being squeezed out of the market, because my feeling is the market will corporatize. It'll be harder to be small, privately owned, independent mom-and-pop ship-owning shops in the future.
I think that is the risk of the transition. I mean, the unintended consequence of the transition. It's hard to manage a transition, make strategic decisions, have access to capital at the scale and the time that you need it, unless you yourself have scale. And so I to understand everything that's happening in the regulatory space, everything that's happening in the different industries. I mean, the next 2 decades, the trade flows will change fundamentally as we move away from the fossil commodities we move around the world today. So all of that has major impacts that will need to be thought through and strategized. And that's really hard for any organisation, but particularly hard for small ones.
Thanks for that. We're coming towards the end of our time, unfortunately, but Marie, I want to ask, is the report available to people if they want to get a hold of a copy? Is there a website they can go to, or is there some way they can communicate with you to get a copy?
Yeah, so the report is publicly available. It should be on UCL website by now. And yeah, people can feel free to contact me if they have further questions or they have, if they have difficulty to access the report.
And if they want to come and model their value at risk, then they can come to you and employ you to do that as a consultant on a huge rate, I'm sure.
Yes, but also the methods are detailed in the report and they're public. And they're not, I don't think they're particularly hard to implement. So, I mean, if I have an advice, is please use that, use the methods, break them and play with them as much as you want. They're not particularly complicated to use.
Thank you. And I have one question, one final question for you each, the same question, which I ask all of our guests. You know, we're moving out of fossil fuels and we're moving into an era of, it could be hydrogen, it could be fuel cells, it could be ammonia, it could be methanol, it could be fairy dust, spaghetti bolognese, who knows? Do you have a fuel which you think will be the winner? You know, what's going to be the long distance transport fuel of the future? Do you have a favorite option?
I really like fairy dust. I think that was my favorite.
I mean, our work is consistently pointing to ammonia as the least cost. That then obviously raises people's concerns about safety, which we share. The economic gap between ammonia and the next cheapest is of the order of 30%. So there's a large, it's not 1%, it's a chunk, which is a strong incentive to address the safety challenge. And I think the problem with safety, you can't talk about ammonia without talking about safety. So that's why I'm going there. But I think the problem with safety is it's so hard to envisage at this point how to overcome things which are fundamentally about operations, identification of hazards, which will be more visible as we build and go through pilots and trials of that particular fuel. So all I can really do is point to the way that LNG was perceived by many stakeholders, including Shell, for example, who wouldn't do ship-to-ship operations to transfer LNG because they didn't perceive that they would be safe. But obviously the evolution of experience and design practice gave us solutions that enabled those to become safe, and now they're not something that those organisations that regularly use them would say they couldn't use. So it's something where cultures and behaviour as well as practices evolve, and we don't see evidence that they cannot evolve for a commodity which we've seen is widely in existence today and has been used for a century. So that's why, and with that gap of economics, that's why we put our kind of analysis in that direction, and the investment so far, especially in the supply chain for that commodity, is moving. We haven't seen the investment move into methanol as a supply chain development because it's fundamentally flawed in its need to have a source of carbon, and that's ironically going to become expensive when you're trying to achieve greenhouse gas reductions.
Thank you for that. Well, listen, thank you very much to both of you for coming on to the Ship Energy podcast. Really appreciate you taking the time out of your schedules to join us. And so, Tristan, Marie, thanks again, and best of luck with your researches, and enjoy the rest of your year.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.